Artist G of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
My name is Artis, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Artis.
Hi, you guys. I want to thank Ann for keeping it simple. She's afraid I'll tell some Ann Q stories. And I'm from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I met Ann there, and I want to thank her for asking me to come to this roundup to share my experience, strength, and hope. I also want to thank Matt and all the committee people have been real nice, and it's been a wonderful conference for me. I've really enjoyed the workshops. And seeing Ann again has been fun. I didn't see much of her, but I did get to share a little bit with her today. The only thing I want to share is that it's a good thing you got Ann. We're glad she's out of Oklahoma. We've all had her. Oh, you think I'm kidding? Anyway, we're here for sobriety, not gossip. And so anyway, I want to tell you a few things that I usually share before I share my experience, strength, and hope. My sponsor always told me to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And but there's a few things I always share you guys before, and I swear it's not for you, it's for me. It's to remind me why I'm behind the podium. By the way, I'm not a circuit speaker. I heard somebody call me a circuit speaker, and let me tell you the difference between a circuit speaker and doing God's will. Okay? I would have paid my way. So the committee should remember that when somebody asks them to come and speak. And that is why I'm behind the podium. I'm still doing God's will and to the best of my ability. And one of the things I have to remind myself is no one speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything I share from here is from my experience, strength, and hope. And it's not... I do not represent AA. The other thing is that anything I share from the podium, there's no original thoughts. Some new people think that when they hear a speaker, we figured all this out. I used to be that way until I got up here and realized all I'm doing is giving back to you what you gave me. And that's all a speaker's doing. And we are fallible and We are bitches sometimes, and I think the speakers are the sickest. I met Clancy. I met all those big speakers, and they're sick. I mean, they're real sick people. The other thing I want to share is that I really try to share what from my heart and not my head and my experience and not opinions or philosophies. And if I share something that offends you, and sometimes I can be offensive, and I don't mean to be, but if I say something that offends you, please, you've got 12 steps, and you've got a sponsor. Okay? I used to say I drank because you stole my land. But I wanted to say that just because I'm in Washington. But hell, I don't even have a row number. That's how Indian I am. But when I think about recovery, I think about the fact that I'm in Washington, D.C., where I was here when I drank in the Army during Vietnam. And during the protesting here and everything. And it's real weird to be back sober, and I can't believe I'm at an AA conference. It's just hard to grasp. But I'm here, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate my sobriety. And I've always, when Ann asked me to speak, I told her, if I don't drink, And that's how I see my sobriety today, is that I still have the capacity to pick up that drink. I choose to, not on a daily basis, or a pill. And I'm also a member of the Al-Anon family group, and my birthday in Al-Anon is January of 85. And without those two programs and the grace of God, I don't think I'd be able to have a sense of humor. It's real hard in alcoholism to see any humor in it when you're new. But there's something I like to do. I've done it. I hope I continue to do it, and it's not to embarrass anyone. But I'd ask everybody with less than 30 days of sobriety, would you please stand up? He sat down. Okay. Okay. Everybody with less than 6 months, would you just stand up for a second? See, that right there, I want to welcome you. The new people still are the most important people, and the long-timers. Without the long-timers and the new people, there's no AA. And that's the way I understand it. And there's something that they told me when I was new in sobriety, in early sobriety, and I've shared it continuously, and it's true. And those of you that stood up, not all of you will make it. And that's the reality of the disease. And when you think about it, and you stood up, and you have less than 6 months, and I know with all my heart that not all of you will make it, is from my experience, not from my judgmental attitude. I've been there, and I stood up, and there are approximately 1 out of 25 find AA, 1 out of 18 die sober. And I've got 11 years, and 17 people didn't make it to 11 years, and I know them. And every time someone dies from the disease, you guys, I put their name in the back of my big book. And I'm not talking about AIDS. I'm talking about the disease of alcoholism, about coming in and going out and dying from the disease. And I carry that big book, and every once in a while I'll be in a big book study, and I'll look back there and I'll see those names. And and one of the guys helped me start a meeting. And so there's a lot more to just going to meeting to stay sober. When we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable, and the first time I saw that step, I didn't get it. My mother was a bartender and owned a bar, and my father was a customer. And I have 7 brothers, Tommy, Ronnie, Warnie, Gary, John, Wayne, and David. And no sisters. And being raised around alcohol and booze and drugs, I did not even comprehend alcoholism. I never heard the word till 1980. And my goal in life, when I remember thinking I should get some kind of goal in life, was, first of all, you got to realize I spent my whole life in beer joints and nightclubs. I really did. I didn't go to the prom. I didn't do any of the social things. I went from junior. I've been gay since I was 14. I'm not a heterosexual who was brought out. And I want to welcome the heterosexuals. Would the heterosexuals stand up? Welcome. All right. See, I know some heterosexuals. They're real nice people. yeah, that's true. The thing about it was, I would go to my mother's bar after school and do my homework or whatever, and then go to the gay bars. And at 14, I had an ID that said I was 32, and my name was Myrtle Smith. I'll never forget it. Let me tell you how I love gay guys. When I went into the 8th Day bar, it was called the 8th Day. I think gay people are so creative. I walked in there at 14, and the softball team told me where it was. And I walked in and I showed that ID. I'll never forget that bartender. He's just as queen as Elizabeth. And he said, honey, if you can spell Myrtle, you can come in. And you know, I could not spell Myrtle. So I went and got another ID. But in Oklahoma, it's against the law to be homosexual. And Oral Roberts emphasized that. And if you've ever been there, it's real. We're about 20 years behind time. I'm overwhelmed with this gay sobriety. It just overwhelms me because, like I said earlier to some friends, that in Tulsa, the gay sober is very small. And we have one gay meeting, and they're all my exes, so I don't go there. That's. I know you think I'm kidding. So Ann moved. She never touched me. You have to think about that if you're from Oklahoma. It's okay. But in the bar scene, it was so natural. And I come from the, I'm 48 years old, and so growing up in the gay community in the 60s, we lesbians protected the gay guys. Obviously, you don't need us anymore. And there was, we only had one bar, and it was always, and there was only one word for us, and it was gay, and we used nicknames. We never used our real names. Mine was Gil, and there was Star, and Silver, and there was just all kinds of nicknames, because in the 60s, in Oklahoma, it was really bad if you got caught. And when the cops would come in the bars, we'd grab a gay guy and sit on his lap, and we didn't know what to do, but we ad-libbed. So all I want to say is, baby, you've come a long way. I mean, gay life has come a long way, but I've learned so much about me because I've never drawn a sober breath, nor have I met a sober person till I came to AA, and that is the truth. I'm overwhelmed that I've only known sober people 11 years. That's a long, long time to be out of sobriety when you subtract 11 from 48. And that's how I understand my sobriety today, you guys, is that I'm still learning what to do sober. You know, I was employee of the month when I worked and drank. I've been fired 4 times in sobriety. And the reason I share that is because I've never done anything in sobriety sober. You have to remember what we're like when we come in. And I'll tell you, I had only three emotions when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that a friend was somebody that stuck by you in a fight no matter whether you were right or wrong. That was a friend. I thought a home was a place you stayed till you were old enough to get out, and I never knew how old that was. Most kids who are raised around alcohol don't, they keep hearing, and when you're old enough to get out, and I go, how old is that? I left at 15, so... And the third emotion that I came within was that a lover was someone I had sex with and split my paycheck with. And that was it. That's all I felt, those three emotions. And the rest was all synthetic. I was in a synthetic personality. And those of us that are in alcoholism, when we come in here, we are synthetic. And the way I did it was bourbon was my booze. I mean, I'll drink anything when I don't have anything, but I mean, if I had a choice, bourbon would be okay. And but I would drink anything. But I remember I would take a shot of bourbon when I was getting ready to leave the house to go to the bars to dance. And then if I went to the bars and I ran into one of you all, and God knows that's what we went there for, was you were to impress me and I was to impress you. I had cocaine, and I would use cocaine to have the intellectual conversation. because I couldn't have one without... Those of us who have had cocaine, let me try to explain it to you. When I took cocaine, I could tell you how to build this hotel. And convince you. So you see, I could be mayor of Washington. I understand why he thinks he can run again. And I understand who's voting for him. I'm supposed to fix recovery. And then here was the part that always was I was so grateful for, and that's when I met her and our eyes met under cocaine when we stared at each other. And I left with somebody. I had to have a quaalude to have sex. Some people say they could get off on other things. I could not even have sex unless I had something to stimulate me. And quaaludes, I always thought they were Spanish flies. But those of us that took them know that you take a quaalude and, honey, anything looks good. Anything. And that's true. And I had to be careful when I took those because you take those and you accidentally go to a straight bar, you're in trouble. And that happened to me. And I'm ashamed of that. I got over it real fast. That does happen. But those three things is what I needed to function on a daily basis. Now, the only time I didn't take anything was at work. And I love my job, and I'm in the medical field. And I was afraid to have anything at work. Not because of being fired, it's just that I felt that the responsibility of someone else's health, whether it was I'm not anybody important, but my part was important. And I felt that anything that I could handle 8 hours, and I did. And I think that my job was just something to substitute because I focused in on that. But the minute 3:30 came, I was at the Inner Urban with the doctors, and we were drinking, and I was telling lies, and they were too. And I would walk. This one doctor that I always like to tell about him, we were so drunk, we got into one of those intellectual conversations because I went to the bathroom and snorted. So I'm at his level now. So we're having on that intellectual conversation, and we're talking, and we're walking and walking in this bar, and I'm standing leaning against the wall, and I'm in the men's room. He's peeing, and we're continuing on with this. Now, that's how uninhibited this stuff can be. And alcohol mixed with these things, I have no inferiority complex. I have no low self-esteem. I'm very synthetic and very up and hip and cool and slick. And it's all because of synthetic feelings, and I've had them all my life. Not from my first drink. I've had a lot of the things. My mom put me on some kind of pills when I was young because I had nightmares all the time, and so I started with pills, you might say, but my first drink came in my late 20s. Because I was raised around alcohol, I thought, oh, hell, I don't want to be a drunk. I hated them. But then I started drinking in my late 20s, and it just bloomed. By 35, I was a full-blown alcoholic and still didn't find you for a while. But I really feel sometimes that maybe I wasn't an alcoholic and that I was just a mental patient, because most of the time on my vacations, I would just go to a mental institution and rest. That's what I did, because I was so insane. I went to jail between drunks. And I was telling a friend not too long ago that when I didn't have anything in my system is when people would say, what are you on? And those that know what I'm talking about I would hear, that's why I had a hard time with AA, because you guys were nuts while you were drinking and I was perfectly fine. I had no, there are times when I think about why I couldn't understand why you didn't want to drink or take a mood altering chemical. And when I came to you through all kinds of crazy incidences, that one of the things I'd like to share is the fact that my first AA meeting was, I went to jail because of some silly little scene I made downtown. I didn't have a drop in me, and my girlfriend had broke up with me, and she was an entrepreneur, and I went into her business, and she told me to get out. You know the scene. And I walked out that door, and I slammed it, and it broke, and it's a public place. And so they called the police, but when the police came, I was at the point that I thought, you know, I've got an education, I've got a home, I've got money, and I am miserable. And I didn't care anymore. But I never thought it was alcohol. It was society. It was pressure of being in Oklahoma and being gay and pretending to live in two lives. And it was everything but that. But when those two cops came and they got out of the car, I remember thinking, this will be it. They'll pull the guns out, they'll shoot me, and this whole nightmare's over. And they just got out, and they didn't do anything, and they started walking towards me, so I started backing up, and they started going a little faster, and so did I. And so I took off running, and they took off running after me, and I kept waiting. When are they going to pull their guns? When are they going to shoot? And they just never pulled their guns, and I even slowed down. But some detective was driving, and he saw me, and he jumped out, and he gave me one of those football tackles, and we all rode, and they threw me in the back of the car, and they said, "Lady, you can't go." And he was talking about destroying this door at this public business. He said, "Lady, you can't go into public places and destroy property like that." And I said, "Why? They destroyed stuff of mine." And he said, "Well, now, if they've destroyed anything of yours, you just go down and file charges." He said, "What did they destroy?" And I said, "She destroyed in here." You guys have said that too, huh? I said, "She destroyed everything in here." And he said, "Oh, God." And he got on the radio. And he said, "We got a mental patient." But I went to that jail, and I had a beeper on because I was on call, and that doctor and I had worked the emergency room many times together, and he was in AA, and he said, "Artis, I'll get you out on your own reconnaissance if you'll go to a meeting." And I said, "You bet. No problem." Now, I'm you got to remember, I went home and looked up reconnaissance. I wasn't sure what this guy wanted. I don't even know if I said it right. I never heard of the word. And it, what it says is basically the guy trusted me. To come back, I guess. I don't know what, because we don't use those words in the bar. Hey, come over here and let me have you share your reconnaissance. I never heard of the word. I just didn't know what it was. So I looked it up. I went to my first meeting, and he took me, and it was, I didn't feel the feeling. You got to remember, I've been sedated all my life, and I was sedated when I went to the meeting. I have a pill for every feeling, and I do not like to feel, and that's what the big book talks about, the effects of alcohol. And I went to the meeting, and I didn't see what the big deal was, and after the meeting, this guy, Frank R., he had 17 years. I'll never forget him asking me. He said, gal, what do you think of this meeting? I said, "Well, it looks like a bunch of old dried up drunks and wore out whores." He said, no, I swear to God, he said, "You come back." So, I did not go back for a while. I drank, and then I went back, and I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous from 1980 to 1983. And I had one time I went to y'all's meeting on my pills but didn't drink. you've probably never done that, where you just go to AA and you just don't drink, but you take a bunch of pills. And I was sitting in the back there like that, and they were giving out chips like they were, and I was sitting by this woman, and I said, what the hell are they doing? They'd say 3 months, and everybody would get all excited. They come up and get a chip, and she said, they're getting chips for time in sobriety. And I said, what is sobriety? And she said, oh, my God. I swear, I'll never forget it. Never. She took me out in the hall, and she explained what sobriety was. In my mama's bar, we never talked about sobriety. And when my mother found out I went to an AA meeting, she said, don't you sign over nothing. She's a character. If she'd have lived long enough, she'd have loved AA. But I had about a year. I got a year one time not drinking with lots of pills, and I celebrated by going and drinking. Then I had about 18 months one time the same way, and I decided to celebrate my birthday, my two-year birthday. I was all pilled up. I went to your dances on Zomax and I was a mess, but I never remember anything y'all said. Y'all just seemed like a bar with the lights on. And you know what? I mean, I was screwed up. I was very screwed up, and you were attracted to me. I'm talking about the women. But anyway, and then one day I hit this bottom, and I was put in a mental institution, and I'd been, and I'll tell you how many times I've been in the mental institution, I would go pre-register me. Because if you've ever been suicidal, depressive, manic depressant, bipolar, all that stuff at once, you can't stand it when somebody says, what is your social security number? 448. I hated that. So I would go pre-register myself, and that way I could go straight to the room. But I was in this room, and they put me in this room, and I was tired again. I was just, that is another bottom. I think we hit thousands of bottoms before we hit the one that says in the 12 and 12, I can't stay sober, I can't stay drunk. I'm going to jump off. That means we're going to kill ourselves or we're going to work the program. That's exactly what that meant to me when I read it. And I was in this mental institution, and they gave me those psychological profile exams. I can't even say it. And they asked me like 500 questions, and this guy was in this room, and he had to watch, and he wanted to get home to supper. You know, they're really in there for us. And if you're in the medical field, please, you got steps, okay? But when you have an alcoholic in a mental institution, you've got a handful, because we're nuts without a drink. You know, we're crazy without a drink. That's why I got in all my trouble between drunks. And he would sit in there and he'd say, now, Artis, I'm going to show you some cards. I want you to tell me what you feel and when you see them. And you know what? Oh, you know what they are, those ink blocks. And I swear, when he'd held them up, they looked like ink blocks. And I'd tell him, I'd say... I'd say they look like ink blocks. And I love this guy. I hope I meet him someday again. But he'd say, Artis, feel. Feel. And I'd look, and I'd say, it looks like ink blocks. He'd say, and he was looking at his watch, and he wanted to get, he works, you know, 8 to 5. And he wanted off, and I'm stuck in this room with him, and I've got to feel something. He's not going to get off work. That's the feeling. Well, I'm in the medical field, and I know my anatomy and physiology very well. And so I got tired of him as much as he got tired of me asking me, so I started making up stuff. I said, oh, that looks like the vaginal canal. Yeah, I did. What's unique about the people in the mental health is he went, good, good. He couldn't even see that I was just, and I say, oh, I got into the female anatomy, I mean, bilateral ovarian cysts. And he went. But the thing was, and then he asked the 400 questions. Artist, do you hear any voices in this room? I went, yes, I do. Yes, I do. He said, do you see anybody in here besides us? Yes, I do. Anyway, these are your top psychologists and your top mental health personnel, because I had insurance. And they sent me back to my room and gave me a shot in the butt, and I went to bed. And the next day I was called in. And I'll never forget it, you guys, as long as I live. And may God please have mercy on me if I ever forget this one day. Now, I was called into the doctor's office, the psychologist and the psychiatrist, and sitting there, and they have taken all my tests, and they had gone through, and they figured out what's wrong with me. And they said, Artis, you're not an alcoholic. You're not a drug addict. You have grave emotional and mental disorders. And a light went off. And I thought, what did you say? And he said, you've got grave emotional and mental disorders. Now, for those that don't know, if you ever listen to How It Works, in there it says, those two with grave emotional and mental disorders, they too can recover if they have the capacity to be honest. And of all the times I was in and out of AA, I remembered that part of How It Works for some reason, because I knew I had grave emotional and mental disorders. And even though I made up some of that stuff, it took that to get me to hear that AA is where I belonged, because I said, I want to go to AA meeting. He said, I just told you, you're not an alcoholic. But what happens when you tell an alcoholic to go north? We don't know why or what circumstances we get to AA, and I don't think anybody ever that I've ever met ever came to AA for the right reasons. But I do know that I insisted on a pass to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they gave me a pass, and I went, and no, I didn't have big awakenings, and it was awful. Because I was just a dry, dry person. Nothing, and I was detoxing. And 3 months in the program, and nothing changed in my life. And I went to my office, and one of those times that I was in before, I had phone numbers, and I told them, I said, what I did was go to my office, and I started calling the phone, because I went to maintenance and got a rope, and I was going to hang myself in my office. But I'm an alcoholic, and I wanted somebody to know I was going to die. I don't think alcoholics like to die alone. And I tried suicide many times, and I always made sure somebody knew I was doing it. But I really wanted to die. And what happened was I took those numbers that I had gotten when I was in AA before, when they told the new person to get phone numbers, and I got them and never called. And so I started calling them, and the lines were busy, disconnected, no one home. I thought, shit, no, you know, nobody's going to know I'm dead in this office. Like, no one would ever come in there. But my alcoholic thinking is that way, and I tried one more number, and the phone rang, and it was Beverly. And I said, Beverly? And she said, yes. I said, you probably don't remember me, but my name is Artis. And she says, oh, I remember you. And I said, Beverly, I've been in AA. I've tried it. I've done everything, and I don't get it, and I'm miserable. My whole life is just impending doom. I'm in such miserable emotional pain. I can't stay sober. I can't stay drunk, and I'm not going to live another day like this, and I don't understand heterosexual sobriety, and there's no gay people around, and I just went on, and she said, I'm going to put you on hold. But you got to remember something. I waited. See, that's an alcoholic, and I had told her I was going to kill myself, and when she put me on hold, I waited. It just seemed like the right thing to do. She came back on the phone, and she said, now let me get this straight. You're going to kill yourself in your office, right? You've been in AA, and it's not working. I said, right. She said, well, why don't you meet me at 5 o'clock for coffee, and we'll discuss a few things, and if you still feel the same way, go ahead and kill yourself. And I thought that sounded logical. Right? I'll never forget it, you guys. I met her, and it was a Wednesday on a rainy afternoon or evening, and she said, now, what's your problem? I said, well, I've tried everything, and I don't even think I'm an alcoholic, and I can't seem to, my life, I just don't, and I have the material things of life. And she said, well, let's look at what's the problem. Do you have a power greater than yourself? And I said, oh, I believe in God. I was raised in Tulsa. And she said, I didn't ask you if you believe in God. Now, here's very important, especially if you're new in sobriety. They didn't ask me if I believed in God. She said, I didn't ask you if you believed in God. Do you have a power greater than yourself? And I said, a power greater than myself. And I would think and think, and she sat there going, a power artist greater than you. It just has to be greater than you. And I was just going. You got to remember, I don't have a sober brain. I'm just the person that's trying, that hasn't had a drink or a pill that day. So I'm going, I don't understand what you're saying. She said, it has to be greater than you, artist. I said, you're talking about God, right? She goes, no, I'm talking about a power greater than you. You and God don't get along. Why would I go to a God to sober me up who said they're going to throw me in hell for eternity? Why would I go to a God that I heard in church all my life thinks I'm full of demons? Why would I go to a God that says that my lifestyle is the abomination of sin? All right? And I heard, nobody put that in my head. I heard that on a daily basis in Oklahoma through church and on TV and through neighbors and through school. So you tell a child or a young person over and over they are a sick person and one day they start believing it. And I started believing that I was sick and that my preference in life was so twisted that why would God want to sober me up so he could throw me in hell sober? That's what I asked her. That's what I asked her. He's going to throw me in hell sober? No way. I'm going there drunk as anybody else. This was a heterosexual woman who was married 20 years, and I'm gay, and she has kids, and I don't, and yet she cared. She cared, and she told me, she said, artist, she says, why don't you use my higher power till you can get your own? And if we'll do some specific things, if you'll do some actions without the thinking with it, and if it doesn't work, you can go ahead and kill yourself. I said, in a meeting? She said, in a meeting. She told me some things. She said, Aris, you can't get your own conception of a higher power because you've already believed that God hates you and dislikes you and no one's going to change that. And you can't change that in a person like me. And she said, use my higher power, do some specific things, don't argue with me, and you do the action no matter how you feel about it. I said, and if it doesn't work, I kill myself because I don't have anything to lose. I'm an absolute miserable person. And I shook her hand and agreed, and she said, okay, I want you to go home, and I want you to thank my higher power, which is hers, for today. And I said, what? She said, go home and thank my higher power for today. I said, but today was terrible. She said, it doesn't matter. You said you'd do the action. And so I went home. She said, get on your knees. And I got on my knees and I said these words. I said, Beverly said, thank you. Help for me to thank you for today. Even though I personally believe it was a terrible, rotten day. Well, when I told her, what she asked me the next day, now what did you say? And I told her exactly. She said, I want you to keep your opinions out of the prayer. She said, Artis, when you get up, ask my higher power to keep you clean and sober today. And I'd get up and I'd say, Beverly said to ask you to keep me clean and sober today. But you know, oh, it was hard not to give my opinion, as if God couldn't hear it. Because I would think it, but I wouldn't say it. And that went on, you know, and I'd sit in the meetings, and here's a great tool that was given to me, and I'm going to give it to you. And if you don't use it, it's your choice. It's a wonderful, very powerful tool. I'd go to meetings, and there were no gay meetings. There were gay people meeting in a house somewhere, but they didn't invite me because even the gay community didn't like me. And that's how twisted I was. And I was a violent, angry woman, and I went to those heterosexual meetings, and I sat there and with those, I called them ball scratchers. I just love them today. That's all they seemed to do in those meetings. I was in some real rough part of town, and I'd sit there and they would, I'd sit there and I'd listen, and then and my sponsor never sat in the meeting with me because she said, I don't want you trying to impress me. Which she was right. And she'd be in another room, and then the meeting would be over, and we'd always sit in the car, and she'd say, how do you feel? And I said, I just don't get it. They all sound like this. And you know, that's called the fog if that's the way we sound to you. So. But the thing that was amazing about it is that she said, I said, I don't relate. You know, I'm queer as a $2 bill. And I said, I don't get it. And anyway, I really believed this in the bottom of my heart, that sobriety was for heterosexuals. I really didn't think it was for people like me. And she said, well, I'm going to give you a tool, and you know, I want you to use it. And here was the tool. Now, you all do it different here. In Oklahoma, we start off with a moment of silence and the serenity prayer, and y'all end it. So it's kind of hard for me here at the conference because I had to hurry and do this tool. But in the moment of silence, this is what I say. I say, let me hear what you want me to hear. Let me share what you want me to share, and I'm willing to have an open mind. There are the three ingredients of how: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And I just said the prayer. I had no idea. I said, what is an open mind? And she said, well, I don't know. I thought it was like a hippie and we're all going to get together and have an orgy or something. But it's not. It's a part of the tools that we need to stay sober, and it's in how: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. I'm willing to let me hear what you want me to hear, let me share what you want me to share, and I'm willing to have an open mind. Now, when I went to that next meeting, I had been going to meetings for 2 or 3 weeks, and I was just miserable. I said that in the moment of silence to myself. And for the first time, I heard something I could relate to. I was relating to these redneck ball scratchers, and it scared the shit out of me when I was relating to them. But I started relating to women in the meetings, and I thought, and I was relating on feelings and not how much we drank or where we drank or how many husbands or wives they had. It was on that feeling of what they had between a drink. And I never could hear it before. And I've seen newcomers come in and they can't hear. They're fidgeting, and you sit there and I'll whisper to them, say this prayer, and I can see it change their face. They hear something. I've been using that prayer now for 11 years in every meeting. Now here I had to hurry because you just start right on in. And I go, oh. And it was hard at first, but And then as I continued to do the things that didn't make sense in Alcoholics Anonymous, our recovery makes absolutely no sense. Our actions are ridiculous. They're hard work. It's things like making coffee, setting up chairs, putting up with personalities over principles, committee meetings, and all these things that we do keep us sober. And then I started working the steps, and she showed me on each step how to work it. You know, I did the fifth step, then I understood the 1, 2, 3. I'm one of those that had to do a fifth step before I got 1, 2, 3. And let me tell you what my first fourth step was. My sponsor told me, she said, "Artis, you've got to get rid of this anger." And she said, "You really don't like God." And I went, "Shh, don't say that." Like he couldn't hear me. I always thought he couldn't hear what I was thinking. And I'm one of those that listen to the Jehovah Witnesses. Because I thought they were God's children, and if I was nice to God's children, then God would be nice to me. And I never dreamed I was one of them. And she told me, she said, "You need to write about that." And my first four step was all the things I hated about God. Everything that he had done to me and that he had made me this way. See, I already knew I was born gay. I didn't need a society to tell me I was born gay. I knew it from the time I can remember. And why would you make me this way and then condemn me? And I never understood that. And I wrote that in my fourth step. And when I went to do my fifth step, I told her to back up a little bit because I knew he was going to strike me dead. And she backed up. She wasn't real sure about me yet. And when I did that first fifth step, I had the most profound spiritual experience. It's almost like the one in the big book about Bill W., but not that graphic. I felt for the first time that there was a God and that he loved me. And not only do I not understand God, but God understands me. And that was what I got out of my first fifth step, was that there is a God. And my God, he does love me just like I am. And I have walked this walk to the best of my ability year after year. And I had to deal with the fact of, and now that there's gay rights and all that stuff, but this was before then, and I had to deal with that. And I was screaming and crying one time after a meeting, and my sponsor said, "What are you so afraid of?" And I said, "I'll tell you what I'm afraid of. I love the sobriety now, but I still think God's going to turn me straight." And she said, "You know, that's a valid fear." She said, "I'll tell you..." What she told me to do, she said, "Why don't you do this, Artis? Why don't you at night tell your higher power that you're willing to be straight?" Ah! I told her, I said, "No!" I screamed, "No!" She goes, "All you have to do is be willing." And did you ever think about it, Artis, that if he turned you straight, you'd like it? It's not something you wouldn't like. And if he doesn't turn you straight, you know you're just the way you're supposed to be. And a lot of gay people in Oklahoma, when they were sobering up, dealt with this fear. And I said, and she goes, "Didn't you think sobriety would be terrible? And now you love it." Well, I would, and their theme at your conference is willingness. And that is the theme here. And that is the biggest willingness I ever had to have. And every night when I would go to bed and get up, I say, "God, I am willing to be a heterosexual." And let me tell you, I got gayer. The fear left me. I've not had a fear, and the innermost self believes that God created me just like I am and loves my gayness. That's straight from the big God. And that's straight from God. No human being gave me that. Now here's the clincher. I'm in a meeting, and this woman shares that she is a heterosexual and she's afraid she's gay. Happens all the time when women sober up. Anne Newer. But I shared with her in the meeting what was so be willing to be gay. And she said, oh, my God. She said, what if I am? I said, you'll like it, because God doesn't change people into something they don't like. And I shared the thing that my sponsor told me. We thought we'd hate sobriety, and we love it. We thought we would hate the spouse we're with, and they turned out to be beautiful or whatever. So this woman did it, and she was full-blown lesbian in 1 week. If you're wondering why we're getting a lot of gay women with children, that's why. But what is it like today? I tell you, in 11 years, at 2 years I was saying, this is great. I mean, sorry, 3 years I was saying, this is great. I don't need any more. I'm just very content. I don't want any more. I love this lifestyle. Yay, yay, yay. That was at 3 years. At 7 years, I thought it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. My God, I thought 3 years was best. 7 years was even better. Now, let me go back to my sixth year. My sixth year, I went to the Persian Gulf War, or seventh year, I can't remember. And that was an experience in itself, being in the Persian Gulf War, and you can thank me for that free oil. But anyway, the thing about it is, at 6 years, I got in a fight with a girl at a bluegrass festival. And we rode around in the dirt at 6 years. And she had 6 months, and I had 6 years. And she said, if you're an example of 6 years, I sure in the hell don't want a 6 year sobriety. And I said, I am the example of 6 years, and you better get ready for it. And she stayed sober, and I stayed sober during that. And then the seventh year, it got great again. And the ninth year, it was wonderful. And those that's been in workshops with me know that I just believe that this program is the most fantastic thing I've ever experienced. What it's like today is that there is something I'm going to give you that is true. And I'm not unique. I'm not different. I don't believe that anything I have you can get in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon. And God will give you what He gave me. He gave me the desires of my heart, or He changed the desires. That's what's gone on for 11 years. I'll have a desire and it will change, and I'm very happy with it, or He gives it to me. Boy, you can't beat that. You just can't beat that. Anyway, the overwhelming awareness of that has been this last year. And I've gone through a lot of pain in recovery. But that pain, I wouldn't trade it for anything outside of AA. I've been close to death. I've been suicidal in sobriety, but it didn't even last long enough to blink an eye. I mean, people, I come to meetings and you let me share my pain, and I tell you, I don't think I'm going to make it. What a bitch, and the next day, it's like it's just a new world. I don't know where else I can get that. I never got it in the mental institutions. I never had a lover that could make me totally happy. I never had the money enough to be ecstatically whole in every area of my life. So it comes from my inside me. It comes from the 12 steps taught me, and still today, a workable, I'm just going to say the 12 steps is something to build a workable, compatible relationship with a higher power. I have my own higher power today, and there are times I like to share how I got it, and it's a long story, and I'm not going to go into it tonight, but I did get my own through listening to other people. But my concept is only this of my higher power. I do not understand God, but God understands me. And that's all that matters. I know that even when there are days that you can't understand where artists is coming from, I know God can. And the Indians call Him the Great Grandfather, because He is a Great Grandfather, and His Son is the Great Father. And that's how I look at my higher power. My higher power doesn't change his mind and only wants the best for me. The only thing I did to wind up in Washington, D.C. and get a free steak from Ann and to stay in a nice room and everything was I didn't take a drink or a pill and I worked the program to the best of my ability. And I winded up here. And I don't know how any way else to put it except the reality of that not all of you are going to make it. Sobriety has to be the most important, the most number one thing in my life. I've changed jobs when I couldn't get to meetings. I've lost lovers because I wouldn't put them before a meeting. I've done through everything about, and I just didn't know where I'm headed. Half the time I just go to a meeting and I've been fired. This is the longest I've ever kept a job. It wasn't my work that I got fired over. It was I didn't know how to deal with people sober. You bothered me, I just took a Valium. I can't do that anymore. And you just don't scream and yell in a staff meeting. And but I want to tell you from the bottom of my heart that sobriety is worth every pain you go through. Don't quit before the miracle. There are so many miracles waiting for us. And you know what the old timers told me? Hell, I ain't even scratched the surface, they tell me. And I'm going, wow, are you crazy? I got everything I want today. I'm 11 years, this is great, I don't need anything else. Just like I said at 2 years, 6 years, 7 years, 9 years. Now I'm 11 years saying the same thing, going, there can't be any more than this. This is the greatest, I feel so whole. I don't have any wants, and I have external problems. Half my family's dead from this disease. The other half is dying today from it. And I've done the best I could with it. But I have the inner peace that they talk about. I'm in the fourth dimension. Thank you.